Hello, my name is Jody Lee Mott, and welcome to Dream Gardens, where we talk up the kids' books we love. On the last podcast, I talked about Ralph Caldecott, whose last name graces the award given each year for the Best in Picture books. On this podcast, I'd like to talk briefly about the inspiration for the other major award in children's books, the Newbery Award. The award is named after John Newbery, who's sometimes called the father of children's literature. John Newbery was an Englishman like Randolph Caldecott, though he lived a century earlier. Unlike Caldecott, John Newbery's claim to fame wasn't as a creator of children's books, though. He was a bookseller and a publisher of both adult and children's books in London, but what set him apart from other publishers was the diversity and quality of the children's books he published, which really helped to popularize and expand the idea of a market specifically for children's literature. The first book he published was called Pretty Little Pocket Book. This is what it says on the title page. Intended for the instruction and amusement of Little Master Tommy and Pretty Miss Polly, with two letters from Jack the Giant Killer, and also a ball and pincushion, the use of which will infallibly make Tommy a good boy and Polly a good girl, to which is added a little songbook, being a new attempt to teach children the use of the English alphabet by way of diversion. According to the records of the time, an actual ball and pincushion came with a book. If the child did something good, they were supposed to stick a pin on the red side and stick one on the black side if they did something bad. Now, a lot of this does sound like a product very much of its time and seems a bit dated, but what was really interesting and very modern about Newbery was this notion that children learn more readily when they're engaged and entertained rather than through the threat of punishment. And in the 18th century, when children were usually viewed as miniature adults, when they were considered at all, this was still a new idea, as was the whole idea of children's literature in general. So while it is probably a stretch to say John Newbery single-handedly created kids' books, he certainly had a huge hand in helping shape the future of kids' books as we know it today. And for that, his name is stamped on the medal known as the Newbery Award. All right, my guest today is Michelle Houts, author of such books as The Middle Grade Adventure Winter Frost and the picture book When Grandma Gatewood Took a Hike. Her website can be found at michellehouts.com. Thank you for joining me today, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, I mentioned this picture book that you wrote, Grandma Gatewood Took a Hike. This is a nonfiction picture book, I understand, about this real-life solo hike that a grandmother took. Can you tell a little bit about that and what inspired you to write that?
Emma Gatewood was the first woman to solo hike the Appalachian Trail and one through hike. So there's several parameters there. There's the fact that she did it solo, so she had no one with her. She was the first woman to do it. Men had done it, but no woman had done it. And in one through hike means that she started the hike and didn't stop hiking until the hike was complete. So the year was 1955, and she was 67 years old. So there are a lot of fit and active 67-year-old grandmothers today, but in the 50s, that's not a, hiking 2,000 miles alone was not exactly what most grandmothers were doing. So she was not who you would have expected to be the first woman to accomplish the task. I came across her one day while I was hiking, not her herself, but I came across a plaque memorializing Emma Gatewood and her accomplishments, and it caused me to dig deeper and do some research. And no one had written about her for children. And I thought this was a story that needed told.
Oh, it sounds like a fascinating story.
Probably the most compelling part of her story is that she failed on her first attempt. And that was something that, you know, is not in the history books. That's something you have to dig into her personal diaries and find out from her own accounts. But she set out to do this the year before she actually accomplished it. And she failed miserably. She got lost. They sent a search party looking for her. She stepped on her eyeglasses. She was bitten by black flies. And within a few days, they were shipping her back to Ohio. And they actually said to her, "Go home, Grandma." So when I visit schools and talk to children about what she accomplished, I tell them the most important part of the story isn't that she made it, it's that she failed and tried again.
Now, what do kids think about this story? What kind of reaction do you get from the kids?
You know, I think a lot of their amazement is that, you know, because the illustrator, Erica Magnus, did a wonderful job portraying her. And they say, "Oh, she's so old. She's so old. How did she do that?" Not realizing until they read the book just what a physical task it was. And it was even harder then because the trail was poorly marked. The trail went through areas that it doesn't go through now. It went through almost impassable areas. And it wasn't just a walk in the woods.
The book you chose today is Tuck Everlasting by Natalie Babbitt, who just passed away last year. And the book was originally published in 1975 by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And just in 2015, there was a 40th anniversary print published by Macmillan. What can you tell readers who are unfamiliar with Tuck Everlasting, what it's about?
Tuck Everlasting, the premise is just one of those timeless premises that 1,000 authors could write a story based on the exact same premise and come up with 1,000 very different stories. But the premise is, what if you could live forever? What if there were some magical thing, place, object, or something that could make you never die? And that's the whole Fountain of Youth theme. It's the whole theme that we find in fairy tales and stories often. But the way Natalie Babbitt chose to approach this whole idea of looking at what if I could live absolutely forever and nothing would ever change? Just how does each character in the story view that premise? And is it as wonderful as it sounds?
And what was it about when the first time you read it that really drew you to it?
The very first time that I read it, I was hooked in the absolute first sentence of the prologue. And that's because I found out that Natalie Babbitt and I had something in common. And if you don't mind, I'll just read those very first lines to you. It says, "The first week of August hangs at the top of summer, the top of the livelong year, like the highest seat of a Ferris wheel when it pauses its turning. The weeks that come before are only a climb up from balmy spring, and those that follow, a drop to the chill of autumn. But the first week of August is motionless and hot." I realized early on as a young child that I saw time in a circle, and I saw the months in a circle in my head. And January sat down at the bottom of the circle about 6 o'clock on the clock, and the year came around that circle until August was up there at 12 o'clock in my mind's clock. And I didn't know that no one else really, well, maybe not no one else, but I thought everyone saw a year in that same way that I did. And when I read that Natalie Babbitt thought that the August was the top of the Ferris wheel, I was so excited. I just felt totally connected instantly to her because we saw time in the same way.
Now, that passage you just read is a good example of how she uses language in her book, that quality of language, which is really remarkable and unique. Now, what do you think about how she really uses words to create these pictures in the book?
One of my favorite scenes is when Winnie Foster's life is one of organization and order. She's an only child in a privileged family. Everything is decided for her, and her life is just very, very regimented. And one of my favorite scenes is when she enters the Tucks' home, which is the home of Angus and May Tuck and their two sons. When she enters their cottage for the first time, and it's in absolute chaos and disarray, and there are trinkets, and there are things everywhere, and there's a mouse that lives in a drawer, and Winnie just can't believe it. And the way Natalie chooses to describe that scene just makes the reader feel like they have just not only stepped into the Tuck's cottage for the first time, but stepped in with Winnie. So we're seeing it as Winnie would have seen it, just that total chaos and disorganization.
And speaking of Winnie, apart from the Tuck, she's the real heart of this book. What would you say about Winnie as a character?
Oh, you see her change. You know, she goes from being restless. Her life is good because it's comfortable and fine. But immediately within the first few pages of the book, we know that she's longing for some sort of adventure. And she's tired of the same old of her life. And yet when she finds the Tuck family, or they find her, and discovers this spring that bubbles water, that if you would happen to drink it as the whole Tuck family did, you would never die. In fact, you would never change from the age that you are now. That seems so intriguing and wonderful to her, and who wouldn't want to? But you see her grow throughout the story, and then you see her become brave beyond what she ever thought she could toward the end when she needs to help the family.
And apart from Winnie and the Tucks, the other major character in the book is this man in the yellow suit, this mysterious character. What do you think he sort of represents?
he's the embodiment of, I'd say, progress for self-serving purposes. He's just out there to promote his own agenda and really doesn't make any difference whose lives are affected along the way. And yet he's so smooth. He's just, he comes in with the smile and all the compliments and all the things that he needs to say in order to get in the door. And I'm not sure that he ever truly has the trust of Winnie's family, but he's certainly trying to earn it. And he's trying in a very slick snake oil salesman kind of way.
When I was reading this book, getting ready for the interview, I hadn't read it for quite a while. And I was struck by a sense of sadness about it that I didn't remember feeling the first time that I had read the book. And I'm just wondering, over the years, has your own reading of the book changed? That is, how you look at the book now, changed from when you first read the book? Do you see different things now that you didn't see when you first read it?
Probably now that I'm older. You know, I've spent a lot of time lately thinking about aging. I'm aging, my children are aging, but probably more so my husband, my family, and I are watching our parents aging into their 80s and thinking about the whole concept of agelessness, timelessness, and forever. It is a sadder book, I agree, than probably I thought it was initially, but I also feel like it's got this great circle of life. All things must come to an end. And, you know, there's a quote. The quote is in the movie, but it's not in the book. And I think many people believe it is in the book, but it's where Tuck and Winnie are in the movie, in the rowboat, and he says to her, "Don't be afraid of death. Be afraid of an unlived life." That quote is often attributed to Natalie Babbitt, but it's not in the book. But Tuck says something very, very similar in the book, and it goes back to that wheel. But he talks about the wheel of life, and he said, he's talking about the ecology of the pond and how the water comes in from the rain, it goes out through evaporation. It's a constant cycle, in that life is part of that cycle. And he again calls it a wheel, and he says it keeps turning, never stopping. And then he says to her that dying is part of the wheel, and it's right there next to being born. So it's, you know, it's that full circle again. You can't pick out the pieces that you like and leave the rest. Being part of the whole thing, that's the blessing. So in a way, it is the same thing as the quote that's so often quoted. But I think as I've aged, I look at this book more being more about dying rather than living forever.
You know, in many ways, it's a very gentle, almost a pastoral kind of book. But at the center of it, and I don't want to give too much away about the book for those who haven't read it, there is this sort of violent action that takes place that's very sudden. And I'm just wondering what you make of that scene and how it fits into the book, because it kind of changes the tone in many ways, very abruptly.
Yes, it does. It does. And as a writer, I think about Natalie writing that scene. I think about the conversations that must have gone through back and forth with the editor. You know, those kinds of things don't appear in middle grade without a great deal of thought and a great deal of conversation about how major events like that change a book and the tone in which they must be told. But the book couldn't really be the book without that happening in there. So yeah, as a writer, of course, I didn't think about that the first several times I read it. But now reading it again, as someone who crafts the plots of middle grade novels, I really would love to have been able to have a conversation with Natalie Babbitt about how that scene unfolded editorially.
Another scene, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's towards the end of the book, when he's sort of given a chance or an opportunity to join the Tucks. And she makes a decision. I won't say what that decision is, but I think what's interesting is we never learn why. We learn what she decides, but we never exactly learn why.
I think the author just used a wonderful opportunity to let the reader insert themselves into that moment. I think every reader probably, by then they've totally connected with Winnie. boy or girl, they've thought, what would I do in that situation? And I think by not explaining it, Natalie Babbitt gave each reader the opportunity to just put themselves in that moment and let their own reasons be the reasons that Winnie chose.
This is the kind of book that compels us to think, what choices would I make? Would I want to be immortal? Is that something you've considered yourself, or is it something that's really not so easy to give a yes or no answer to?
I don't think those are easy, you know, what ifs to think about. I think probably as a child, I probably gave that more thought than I do or would now. But those are difficult situations where you think, why should I spend the time considering that? That's never going to be an option.
Well, what did you think as a child, considering that question?
You know, probably reading the book, I had different thoughts at the beginning as a child than I did at the end. Sure, I think everyone would think, oh, it'd be great to be 12 forever. It'd be great to never grow old. You know, children see their grandparents and the struggles they go through. But then I think that the wisdom in the book lies in Tuck and his words. And then even the oldest son, his experiences with this agelessness, this everlastingness, haven't been all positive. And it makes even a young reader really think before they get to the end of the book, would it be all that great or not?
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today about this book. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share some thoughts.
Thank you for joining me on Dream Gardens. The theme music, titled All Together, is provided courtesy of Purple Planet Music. You can visit them at www.purple-planet.com. Podcast cover art is provided by Creative Pro 180, courtesy of Fiverr, which can be found at www.fiverr.com. You can visit me at jleemott.com, that's jleemott.com, or follow me on Twitter at DreamGardensJLM. Dream Gardens Podcast is also available through iTunes and Stitcher. Until next time, keep dreaming, keep growing, and keep reading.